From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the unintended consequences of the Trump tariffs on foreign metal.
We're looking at 2.5%, 3% growth in the economy, and all of a sudden, does that start to ratchet back?
This is going
to
cost money. This could cost our firm several hundreds of thousands of dollars this year.
Support for families facing the crushing diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease.
They say, well, you know, you have Alzheimer's disease. Set an appointment for 6 months from now or a year from now, and we'll check back and see how you're doing. And that's the end of the conversation.
Politically active high school students holding a debate for gubernatorial candidates.
I think the disconnect between our politicians and the public is a serious issue that we want to solve.
And ice climbing in the magical Upper Peninsula. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There is confusion today in the White House over just how and when to roll out President Trump's planned tariffs on imported steel and aluminum. It appears the president is considering exempting some of our allies, including Canada, Mexico, and Australia, but details are still very uncertain. However, if the president proceeds with his 10% tariff on foreign aluminum and 25% on foreign steel, Detroit News business columnist Daniel House has a three-word warning: unintended consequences loom. Daniel, what kinds of unintended consequences?
Well, I think a lot of things. I mean, if you're a domestic automaker and you're buying steel and aluminum to manufacture cars, trucks, and SUVs, your prices are going to go up, even if the lion's share of it comes from U.S. producers. Already there are reports that U.S. steel and aluminum producers are raising prices even before these things are enacted into law, and that's going to have an impact on the cost structure of these companies. That's one potentially serious consequence. Even more so if foreign governments start to retaliate, which I think they've already signaled that they would do, then you have something that starts to metastasize and widen. I mean, if they all of a sudden slap tariffs on Harley-Davidson's coming out of Wisconsin, as an example, or bourbon coming out of Kentucky, or Levi jeans coming out of San Francisco, which all, by the way, happen to be represented by very prominent politicians in Congress.
Yes.
All that does is continue to widen. So I think one of the real concerns here is that it snowballs, and we're looking at 2.5-3% growth in the economy, and all of a sudden, does that start to ratchet back? What impact does that have on already plateauing auto sales, for example? Do people start to say, you know, I guess I can keep driving this car for a little bit longer. I don't really need to do this right now. And I think that's one of the other fears, is that what the Brits call the knock-on effect. How does one thing affect another, and then all of a sudden, you're looking at substantially slowing growth?
And you've got a president tweeting, trade wars are good.
Well, we also have a president that isn't a very good student of history. Trade wars usually end up hurting a lot more people than they're designed to solve. You know, and when this president starts to run for re-election and comes back to the Midwest, he may be faced with a very different picture than he thinks. I mean, he may be welcomed as the conquering hero in steel towns and by some steel mills, but auto plants, I'm not so sure. Again, in Wisconsin, at the Harley-Davidson plant, not so sure. And these are his core voters. These are the people that have supported him the first time. I think he doesn't have a very good understanding of how all of this fits together. And also the fact that he makes these pronouncements, and to the point you said at the open, doesn't have the details, is very problematic. It's not new for him, but it's problematic. I talked to a member of Congress yesterday that said, we don't have the details. Other members of Congress are writing letters and saying, you know, please be more targeted. If China is the problem, and Russia is the problem, and Brazil is the problem, focus what we're doing here on steel and aluminum coming out of those countries. Don't impact Canada and Mexico. Don't use this as leverage over NAFTA negotiations. Don't get into a big cock-up with the people in the EU. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't seem to be sympathetic to that argument.
Well, his tweets are not aimed at China and Russia. His tweets have been smacking at Canada and Europe.
Oh, that's exactly right. And as a lot of your listeners know, the renegotiation of the North American Free Trade Agreement has been going on for some period mm-hmm. of time. And I think the administration is very clear that they're using the threat of these tariffs against Canadian steel primarily as leverage in these negotiations. We buy more steel in the United States from Canada, I believe, than any other country. They are a major player. We consume more than we produce, so we have to import steel into our industry and our manufacturing industries, which is not just autos, by the way. It's a lot of hard goods, durable goods, food service, all sorts of other things.
And as U.S. carmakers get hit with potential double-digit increases for their metal, what's going to happen with the foreign competitors?
Well, that's an interesting point. And my understanding is that cars that are made in Germany, South Korea, Japan as three examples, and brought into the United States, and they're assembled with finished foreign steel. So it's foreign steel that is in those panels, in the bodies of those vehicles, pay a 2.5% import tariff. So if you're looking, if you're a domestic manufacturer and you're looking at steel getting a 25% tariff, you're going to be disadvantaged because all these manufacturers, while they do assemble vehicles in the United States, they do not assemble all the vehicles in their portfolio in the United States. So there are Mercedes and BMWs and Volkswagen and Audi brand vehicles that are manufactured outside the United States but are sold to Americans in American dealerships. So I think the fear right there from the companies is you're going to put us at a cost disadvantage, and that's not right. So what does the administration do? I think the expectation is, well, let's just slap tariffs on those cars too. You can see how this very quickly snowballs. You know, the president of the United States is not king of the world. And these other foreign nations, they're sovereign, and they are well within their rights to react to protect their own industries if all of a sudden they are being disadvantaged in one of the largest markets, in a lot of ways, the largest market in the world.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's stay with the unintended consequences of President Trump's proposed tariffs. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross made the rounds of cable news shows to insist this will not be a big deal. Here he is last Friday on CNBC holding a can of Coca-Cola.
Coca-Cola has 3 cents worth of aluminum in it. So if that goes up 10%, that's 0.3 cents. I just paid $1.49 for this can of Coke. It doesn't mean anything. So all this hysteria is a lot to do about nothing.
So let's find out what the craft beer industry thinks of this 10% tariff on imported aluminum. Brad Stevenson is with us now. He's chief production officer of Founders Brewing in Grand Rapids. Brad, Commerce Secretary Ross says this hysteria is a lot to do about nothing. What do you think?
Well, it's actually going to cost us quite a bit of money, and it's going to cost us money. It has already started, and it's going to probably continue for a while.
How so?
Well, before the tariff announcement of just last week, this actually started last spring with some signals coming from the administration that immediately were reflected in increased aluminum pricing. And we've been watching it march up steadily since then. In fact, we entered into a contract to forward buy aluminum because we couldn't afford to let it get any higher last fall. So we're protected for a short bit into the future, but this is only going to make the price keep rising.
And it is interesting because Secretary Ross says nobody should be surprised by this. This has been in the works for quite some time. So as you say, prices have been going up. Can you give us an idea how much, from what to what?
So in the 6 months from April to October of last year, we watched the cost of aluminum rise about 10%. And that's when we locked into some forward buying contracts. Since then, it's continued to go up by another 5%. And that's all before this most recent talk of tariffs.
How much of your product is canned?
Well, it's become more than half of what we output is in a can. And I also know from the blurb you just played from Mr. Ross that we clearly pay a lot more for cans than Coca-Cola does. So it is a little more impactful for someone our size. And certainly if you're even smaller than Founders, you're paying more per unit per can. This is going to cost money. This could cost our firm several hundreds of thousands of dollars this year.
And it is interesting, we're even hearing the big beer companies, Miller Coors, for instance, complaining very publicly about it, but they're certainly able to weather these higher costs much differently than a small craft company like yours.
They sure are, and I think the point in there is that all of us, the big beer and craft beer, we don't have the option of passing the price on to the consumer, not that we would even want to. We're just going to take the extra cost and absorb it.
Why is that? Why don't you have that option?
Well, we don't have that price flexibility. There's too many other people out there who, like you just mentioned, the big beer company. If we were to raise our price and they don't, we're all of a sudden out of alignment. So this is one of those cases where the manufacturer, us, will take the price and we'll just eat it, and it'll take money from other things we might have done.
Yeah, it might be instructional for people to understand the preference for cans over glass bottles. So how do cans stack up to glass bottles for being able to deliver your product?
Sure. So it turns out that the people that enjoy craft beer happen to have a lot of things in common. And one of those things is they're very active. They like to take our product into places that are fun to be. Those places could be near waterfronts. They could be on a golf course. They could be at a concert venue. They could be out in the back country. And in all those areas, cans are just easier to transport and they're more durable than a glass bottle.
How much of your metal is foreign sourced?
I don't actually know that because our can manufacturer is domestic, and I don't know the componentry of their raw material.
Okay. I know MillerCoors tweeted out that there is not enough can sheet aluminum available in the U.S. to satisfy the demand.
Well, that is true. I know there's a foreign component. I still don't know the percentage that is coming from offshore.
There's been this theme from brewers since the president announced that this is a particularly bad time for the industry for these tariffs. Can you talk about that? Why is that?
I think that the industry is going through some price tightening in general, so people are really held on what we can charge for our product. The expectation is that our price to consumer is coming down. So when you have your costs going up and your price to consumer coming down at the same time, that's tough.
President Trump says these tariffs are needed, Brett, because foreign steel and aluminum pose a risk to national security. What did you think when you heard that?
So I'm no expert on that field, but it does seem like a stretch. I'm not sure how to follow that logic. And what I've learned in the last 7 days is that a lot of our imports are coming from our allies. So it's not making sense to me.
The president certainly seems intent that he will impose these tariffs. So you say prices have been going up already. You tried to grab up as much as you could at an existing price. So you're watching, you're waiting, but you kind of are joining with the beer industry and saying this is altogether not going to work for you.
Certainly. And then this has all been about aluminum in this conversation. There's steel component. We all buy a lot of kegs as well. So we have yet to dive into that one.
Boy, so where are you going to go with that? That's an actually good point. We were thinking about the cans, but when you talk about these kegs.
It has 2.5 times the penalty on the tariff, 25% versus 10%. And we literally have not started that project yet. It has to do with we buy kegs a few times a year and we buy cans every day. So we're going to be going there next.
Brad Stevenson, Chief Production Officer, Founders Brewing in Grand Rapids. Thanks for talking with us, Brad.
Yeah, no problem.
Coming up, Detroit's Eastern Market is hosting a vegan celebration today. In attendance will be a former Wolverine offensive lineman who says the switch to a plant-based diet saved his life.
Once we adopted this lifestyle in December of 2011, I was off all five of my medications in 2 months, and in 3 months I had lost 45 pounds.
That is in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are lots of ways to make the most of winter in Michigan. How about climbing frozen waterfalls? Just ask Angela Van Wiemersch and Sasha DeJulian about swinging their picks and climbing Michigan ice. Angela is originally from Southeast Michigan. She is known as the Ice Queen. Sasha is a world champion rock climber. She came to Michigan to climb ice with Angela, and they're with us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having us today.
Angela, tell me, how and when did you first get into ice climbing? Because I've read you grew up in Southeast Michigan. I can't think of a lot of frozen high walls and columns of ice in this corner of the state.
I actually did not find ice climbing until I had left Michigan. I was just traveling around in 2013 when I first heard of ice climbing based in Colorado. And it was an evolution once I picked up the sport on how to get back and how to climb ice in Michigan. I got wind of all the opportunities up here, and it was, you know, close to home and close to my heart. So I had to come back and climb it.
And I know now you kind of, especially in the wintertime, make your base in the Upper Peninsula. So is that the best place to find good ice climbing spots in the state?
Within Michigan, yes. It's a mecca. There's hundreds and hundreds of ice climbs concentrated in a really small radius, which makes it super unique and just so magical.
And Sasha, you are a star in the rock climbing world. So what turned your interest toward pure ice climbing?
Climbing has so many different facets to it, and you could be a champion in one side of the sport and then still have a lifetime of new experiences to have. So with rock to ice, there are significant differences, but it's also a part of the sport that I do. So I think that I was mainly motivated to go out and learn with Angela because it would broaden my horizon of what I was capable of in climbing.
So did you find it hard, Sasha, to transition from rock to ice? I'm wondering what the big differences were, besides what you had to wear and what the temperature is.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that one of the most challenging things for me was just getting my brain around the fact that, one, it's not very safe to fall. And in rock climbing, I fall like 99% of the time. I have a rope and I have gear. Whereas ice climbing, it's not like you don't have a rope, but it's not really encouraged to take that fall with like swinging spiky objects all attached to you and ice screws into frozen water. That was one obstacle that I had to kind of overcome, was gaining enough confidence to understand that I could do something and I wasn't going to fall. But and then another significant factor was just with climbing, you're using your bare fingers and your toes and everything is very sensitive. So you're going off of what you feel. And with ice climbing, it's more of you're going off of what you hear and what you feel through the vibration of a third party. So that's your ice axe and your crampon. So just not having that direct connection, having this separate entity in between you and understanding how to become one with your tools and with your gear was another, I think, factor that I kind of had to wrestle with.
And so, Angela, what was the hardest thing for you to teach when you were taking Sasha and saying, all right, we're going to go tackle this ice? What was the hardest thing to impart as far as knowledge?
I think the hardest thing, and it wasn't really teaching because it's something that comes with time, but just really making sure that when Sasha embarked to lead climb, which is when the rope's below you instead of above you, that what she had touched on was that she was really confident and familiar. Because watching her, and if I was close enough, I knew what a good tool placement was. You know, I had confidence in her swing, and I knew when it was good. But really making sure that she embodied that, and as she moved forward, you know, when she climbs in other alpine settings and as she progresses as a well-rounded climber, that she's going to know what's good. And that will come, and it was really amazing. She did her first lead, and I felt so confident watching her because she had gotten to that point where she knew what was good. But, you know, with anything, you got to just put in time and hours. And I think embarking in that direction, the first couple times are going to be challenging, you know? I mean, that's why we do this sport. We challenge ourselves.
And I'm interested, so take us on a typical climb. First of all, how high might you typically be climbing, and what is it you're climbing, Angela?
We climb anything in Michigan from around 50 feet to, really, we did a route that was 240 feet. So there's a big spectrum based on the location, the formation of the ice. And it's kind of choose your own adventure. A lot of the ice here forms really steep in pillar-like columns. You can see from some of the photos online and other climbs, a little more unique to the area, but they form like big smears, we call them. They're low volume, forming water seeps out of the wall, and they create kind of a streak of plastered ice on the cliff band.
Well, one final question, Angela. Are you ready to enter Sasha's climbing world and do some serious rock climbing?
I'm so excited. It's been such a goal of mine to broaden my spectrum. And I think when you get into your respective groove, you know, you really chase that. And I've been able to push the sport in ice. And, you know, what I strive to do with that side of climbing has really, you know, mandated a lot of my trips and a lot of my time throughout the year. But I'm putting my foot down. And with Sasha's help, we're going to team up and we're going to do a few projects in the fall. And I'm already starting to train, and I'm going to be heading out west to do some work with her over the summer. And I couldn't be more excited to have somebody like Sasha show me the ropes. It's going to be so good.
And I hear you're heading to Africa with Sasha this year.
Yeah, Africa. We're going to go to Morocco.
Well.
Oh, yeah.
And I know you've been doing projects for Red Bull and these film series that are very available online to be able to watch the two of you in action. They are something to watch. And I bet a lot of young women can look up to you and go, we want to be able to do that. So will you be continuing the film series when you're in Morocco?
We sure hope so. I think we got to get some stuff in the works, but there'll definitely be some sort of documentation. And you know, it's International Women's Day today, which is really cool that you're interviewing us today.
You are inspiring us, I can tell you that. Well, Angela Van Wiermersch and Sasha DeJulian, we want to thank you for sharing your ice climbing adventures with us.
Of course.
Thank you so much.
Today at Detroit's Eastern Market, there's a celebration of all things vegan. It's called V313. Organizers promise food from local vegan restaurants, music by local plant-powered musicians, and educational speakers. Mark Ramirez will moderate the Vegans of Color panel discussion. He's co-founder of Chickpea and Bean. It's a nonprofit which hopes to raise awareness and educate people on the benefits of a plant-based lifestyle. Ramirez is also a former football player for the University of Michigan. Here's Stateside's Lester Graham speaking with Ramirez back in 2016.
You were right guard, right? You played. When did you play?
So I played the years 1986 through 1990 for the legendary Bo Schembechler.
So big guy. You were physically active. You pretty much ate whatever you wanted. You stayed healthy. Then you graduated, and without all those workouts and running up and down the field, you started to gain a little weight, starting to have some health problems as the years went by. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so it was about 12 years out of college. I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. At that point, I was probably about 260 pounds. And unfortunately, I was taking 5 different medications. And it's no wonder, because my entire family struggled, Lester, with diabetes, my entire family.
Yeah, it tends to be a genetic thing. I mean, my father had it, my mother had it, and I understand what you're talking about. How bad did it get for you? You mentioned 5 medications?
Yeah, so in 2002 that I was diagnosed with the diabetes, you fast forward to 2011, and in that decade of having type 2 diabetes, I had also come down with high blood pressure, mm-hmm. high cholesterol, and I was taking 5 different medications for that. I was taking 2 insulin shots a day, 2 oral diabetic medications, a high blood pressure and high cholesterol medication.
But because it's a family trait, you know, a lot of people just say, well, this is the hand that I was dealt. But you were offered a gift of a video, and you watched this thing called Forks Over Knives. What is that?
So it's a documentary that chronicles 2 doctors, one who spent the majority of his career out of Cornell University, and the other who spent the majority of his career out of the Cleveland Clinic. And these 2 doctors, they're in their early 80s today, Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn and T. Colin Campbell. And what they ultimately reveal in all their years of research and study is how harmful animal foods can be to the human body.
That have an impact on you? What happened?
It absolutely did. So my wife and I, after a decade of being sick, taking these 5 medications, and you know, I need to mention too, Lester, that on top of the diabetes, high blood pressure, and cholesterol, I also had erectile dysfunction. I had psoriasis all over my scalp. I had heartburn all the time, and I was tired very often. So we watched this documentary. We read Dr. Neil Bernard's program for reversing diabetes, and these 2 actions changed my family's trajectory forever. Once we adopted this lifestyle in December of 2011, after, again, being sick for a decade, I was off all 5 of my medications in 2 months, and in 3 months, I had lost 45 pounds.
Now, you were off your medication. This is after you checked with the doctor, right?
Yes, working with the doctor and seeing my blood work. And again, as a diabetic, we're frequently checking our glucose levels multiple times a day, injecting the insulin. So I could see 3 to 4 days into this lifestyle of going plant-based, my sugars just plummeting and really starting to lose weight, and I was feeling so much better.
Now, by nature, I'm a skeptic. I mean, I'm a reporter. So we've all heard about these miracle diets, these exercise regimes. How is this different than some of those?
Here's the funny part about this. In that decade of being sick, I had tried to count carbs, count calories, portion control, exercise more, eat less. And while I may have realized some benefits, I lost a little weight, or maybe I even felt a little better, I was never able to eliminate the medication. So it wasn't until I changed the food, went to and adopted a whole foods plant-based lifestyle, that I started to see immediate impact with my results and ultimately eliminated all 5 of those medications in 2 months.
Now, I read in your bio somewhere that you had talked to your doctor earlier and you asked him when you first had to start taking insulin injections, how long am I going to have to do this? And he said, forever.
That is correct.
So when you came back to him and all these changes had taken place in your glucose levels, in your blood pressure and cholesterol, what was his or her response?
He was actually amazed, because I did ask him, Doc, will I ever get off this medication? And he flat out told me, you're going to be on insulin the rest of your life. And so when I came back to him and said, hey, Mark, you're the poster child for a type 2 diabetic, and you are my star patient.
Everybody's metabolism is a little different. Is there evidence that everybody can benefit from these changes that you've made?
There is so much evidence. I mean, there's 5 different doctors that we love and follow and have been doing this for decades, Lester. This is not new information, but unfortunately, there's a lot of marketing marketing about a lot of the foods out there that most Americans eat, fast food. I mean, everywhere you turn, there's marketing for all this fast food, and unfortunately, it's a lot of unhealthy food.
But I can imagine the meat processors and the pork industry and the cattle industry are not happy with you right now.
Well, you know...
And the dairy industry, and can I go on?
It's big business, right? And unfortunately, I have nothing against any of those industries, but what I do and try to promote is being healthy and seeing what has happened to me. And Lester, we've been having chickpea and bean. We've been having free meeting since January of 2015.
Yeah, tell us what that is. This is the nonprofit corporation that you and your wife started. What does chickpea and bean do?
Our mission statement is to help educate people about the power and benefits of a plant-based lifestyle. We've seen such dramatic change in our family here immediately. And I've also had so many other people since then that have adopted this lifestyle, Lester, that they've eliminated medications, lost weight, felt better. And we see so many people around us. And in fact, we are continuing this. And pretty much Chickpea and Bean is a nonprofit organization. It's my wife and I, like you said. I'm Mexican, so I'm Bean. She loves chickpeas, and she is chickpea, and thus we are Chickpea and Bean, and that's our website, chickpeaandbean.com. Everything is free on our website. There's nothing for sale. We're doing this to try and inspire others to really think about food as a way of healing themselves.
Now, I can see that you are thoroughly convinced this is the only way to go. I wonder, though, if you think that someone could do primarily what you do, just cut back on animal fat, cut back on the cheese. I mean, is a way to do this in moderation, or is the only way to get the kind of results you got is the way you're doing it?
I think, Lester, that if I had one burger a month or a little bit of animal product here and there, I might still be not quite as healthy, but I think that you could realize a lot of the benefits. However, I think about moderation, and I think about many of us struggle. A lot of this food is addicting. Cheese in particular. I hear about cheese. Oh my gosh. A lot of these foods are addicting. So what I tell people is if you can just figure out a way to cut it out. Plus, there's also so many substitutes for a lot of these products that are out there today that you can purchase.
We've been talking with Mark Ramirez about the health benefits he's seen by switching to a whole food plant-based diet. He's inviting people to see what it's all about. You can get more information at chickpeaandbean.com. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Lester.
And Mark Ramirez is leading a discussion at today's V313 Festival at Detroit's Eastern Market. So there I was, scrolling through my Twitter feed, when one tweet jumped out at me. It had a photo of a big orange tabby cat wearing a Smokey the Bear-style police hat and some traffic cop-style mirrored sunglasses. And the tweet from the Troy Police Department read, "If we get 10,000 followers by April, we want a police cat. If you support this important public safety initiative, follow us and retweet #BigGoals, #PoliceCatAssociationOfAmerica. Well, we just had to find out more about the quest for a police cat for the Troy PD. With us now, Sergeant Megan Lehman. So what's behind the push for a police cat?
We love cats. We would love to have a cat in the workplace, just probably like anyone else would like to have a pet at the workplace.
I was actually struck as I looked at the responses to your tweet. There have been some good ones. Somebody sent you a photo of their prosecutor cat snoozing at a desk. And then there was a little teasing from your colleagues at the Michigan State Police. It seems they're a little more dog people.
Yeah, it seems that way. And we do have dogs, too. We have three canines.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, they're like, yeah, we're not so sure about a cat. But are you hearing from any other departments with their own police cat?
No, we are not aware of any police department, at least anywhere around us, that has a cat. I have heard something about a fire department, but no police department.
And I know you've been kind of listing these on the Twitter feed. Give us a couple of the ways a police cat might just help the Troy police fight crime and keep the peace.
Well, in truth, we would think a police cat would be more of a community relations tool and a member of our department. We don't know about the law enforcement capabilities of cats. No one really does at this point. Could they have some skills we can use? I mean, maybe we're going to find out.
But they can keep officers chilled out, somebody to pet.
Exactly.
You know, and talk a little more about how you use this Twitter account to kind of engage the community, because you really do some fun and creative things. But there is, as you say, there's this kind of underlying theme.
Yes. Our main goal is kind of to, what they say, humanize the badge and show people that we're people too. We want to get news out there and public safety information too, but people aren't going to tune in just for bad news. They're not going to follow us just to, you know, get robotic, boring tweets. They need fun stuff too, and that's kind of the goal with this. The overall goal is just showing people what we're like, that we are humans and we're part of the Troy community and the greater Metro Detroit community as well.
Well, I just have to let you know, Megan, some of the gang here at Michigan Radio has now a serious case of cat envy. And so they think, yes, you ought to get your police cat. And now they want public radio cat. So look at what you started.
Awesome.
You can follow the Troy Police Department on Twitter and check out their hashtag, We Want a Police Cat. Sergeant Megan Lehman, you're giving yourself to April to get those 10,000 followers.
Exactly.
All right. Well, best of luck. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Sergeant Megan Lehman joined us via Skype. Still to come.
Why couldn't we just host a gubernatorial debate? We just thought, well, why not? There was no good reason why we couldn't get involved. We're both registered voters at this point.
And we'll talk with two students who helped get some Democratic candidates for Michigan governor to come to their high school for a debate this weekend. That's in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Every 66 seconds, someone in this country is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. It is the sixth leading cause of death in this nation. And as we all get older, that incidence will increase. On Wednesday's program, we heard a firsthand account of the challenges of early onset Alzheimer's, a woman whose dementia began in her mid-50s. Her husband and daughter shared their story.
It takes people away, but they're still there. And that's hard to watch. It's really hard to watch your loved one fade away.
There was something about for better or for worse. And my wife and I have had at least our fair share of better. And now it's time for the other.
What support is there when a family like theirs is coping with a disease that has few, if any, options? We turn now to Jennifer Howard. She's executive director of the Michigan Great Lakes chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Jennifer, how many people in Michigan are living with Alzheimer's right now?
There are currently over 180,000 people living in the state of Michigan with Alzheimer's disease. Another way to look at that is for those that know the University of Michigan football stadium, it's mm-hmm. about enough people to fill that stadium mm-hmm. 1.5 times. In addition to that, we have more than 500,000 people who are caring for a loved one with Alzheimer's disease full-time living in the state of Michigan.
How do you define, Jennifer, younger onset Alzheimer's, the kind that Kathleen and her family have been dealing with?
Well, younger onset Alzheimer's, sometimes called early onset Alzheimer's, simply means that the symptoms are starting or they're noticed before the age of 65. Mm-hmm. It's more rare. There are only about 200,000 people in the United States that have younger onset as compared to over 5 million who have just regular later onset at age 65 or after. But the symptoms and the progression of the disease looks very similar.
What kind of symptoms should people watch for? I guess I'm asking, how do we tell the difference between garden variety forgetfulness
sure.
and something that could be more profound?
Absolutely. We get these questions all the time, and people talk about having these senior moments, and people get scared. The important thing to know is that our brains are aging with the rest of our body. So there are normal age-related changes to memory and to thinking. It'll take us longer to recall a name. We're going to get distracted a little bit more easily. We're going to lose our car keys more often. And that's absolutely normal. But when the changes are so profound that they're starting to affect someone's day-to-day life, that's really when we start to take notice. A lot of it is people having problems with the things that they normally did well and they can no longer do or they're having great difficulty with.
And I've got to imagine people with younger onset Alzheimer's are probably getting diagnosed when they're still employed, figuring they're going to have years more of earning power. So what kind of benefits are out there for people?
When someone has younger onset Alzheimer's, they're often in the prime time of their working career. So a lot of them are in their 40s or their 50s, and they're really at their highest earning level that they've ever had. They're trying to prepare for retirement, and they're often in the position where not only are they preparing for their own retirement, they've got kids in college that they're trying to get through school. And then this happens. In fact, some of the folks with younger onset Alzheimer's, some of the first things that they notice is they're having difficulty at their jobs. We've worked with families of folks who have lost their jobs because of bad performance, because they were missing things at work. And then they were later diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And so it presents an especially challenging problem for the folks with younger onset. They're not prepared for this. Not that anyone ever is at any age, but the cost is absolutely devastating. And there really is nothing in place. There are no systems in place to care for someone with Alzheimer's. For example, long-term care or respite care, two things that are very important normally later in the disease. Medicare doesn't pay for assisted living. Medicare doesn't pay for respite care to come into your home and to help somebody to give the caregiver a break. Medicare will pay for medical care. So Medicare will pay for doctor's appointments and those types of things. But families aren't prepared for this. And this is usually the majority of the cost of this disease.
Is there anything that could be done proactively? Let's just say that people are hearing us talk and thinking, well, maybe I can do some things right now to at least prepare in case.
You know, I talk to people and I always say, we're all planning for our retirement. We're all saving for our retirement, but none of us are saving for our Alzheimer's. You know, who's planning on having Alzheimer's and the cost that it might hit us later in life? But one of the things that people can do is to buy long-term care insurance. I mean, not just for Alzheimer's disease, but really for anything that might happen later in life. Mm-hmm. People that are relatively healthy can get it at a reasonable rate. That's something that people could do in their 40s or 50s or later. But I think the important thing is that if somebody is diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or suspects, get help. Reach out and get help. Know that there are community resources out there. You know, the Alzheimer's Association has a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week helpline that people can call at 800-272-3900. That might be one first step. And what we try to do is to help families to find affordable respite care, to find affordable long-term care, to get the help that they need. From community to community, the resources are different. So it's important to talk to somebody who knows that community. There are some free programs out there, some free respite type of programs, transportation services, you know, just all sorts of beautiful community resources, but most people just don't know that they're there. So I would say, you know, reach out to the Alzheimer's Association. Reach out to your area agencies on aging for help. There are lots of places that are good first steps.
What do you see as far as ways that you see people kind of just accept or begin to cope with the fact that this is not going away? This is going to be their reality with their loved one for who knows how many years.
What's unique about Alzheimer's is that the reality that people are living with changes almost daily. In the beginning, when you get this diagnosis, what people go through, they normally notice that changes are happening. They see their doctor. If they're lucky, they get a proper diagnosis. They see a neurologist. They do neuropsychology testing, and they get a really good diagnosis, make sure that what they're experiencing is Alzheimer's and not something else causing the dementia. But once Alzheimer's is diagnosed, they're dealing with a fatal disease diagnosis and one that really has no effective treatment. So, you know, if you get any other kind of diagnosis, let's say you get a cancer diagnosis, there's a treatment plan and a support system that's put in place for you. When you get an Alzheimer's diagnosis, what normally happens is they say, well, you know, you have Alzheimer's disease, set an appointment for 6 months from now or a year from now, and we'll check back and see how you're doing. And that's the end of the conversation. So that's especially challenging. But even once the family has come to accept that, and even if they have done research and they've educated themselves about what this means and how to plan for the future legally, financially, you know, getting everything in place that they need to, their daily reality changes all the time. The things that are challenges today may not be challenges a month from now, but you may have a whole different set of challenges. So the families go through this constant adjustment and sort of recalculation of what they have to do and the supports that they have to put in place.
Now, what about risk factors? I know there are certainly, with certain cancers, there are very, very clear risk factors, so you might consider yourself at higher risk. Does that exist, especially if somebody like Charlene is watching her mother go through this? Does someone with a parent, let's say, with Alzheimer's, will they be at higher risk?
So what we know is that there are some genetic components to Alzheimer's disease. There are some genetic markers for Alzheimer's disease. But even if you test positive for these genetic markers, it doesn't mean that you will ever develop the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. So in Charlene's case, because she has a mother with Alzheimer's disease, it definitely increases her risk, but it doesn't necessarily mean that she will ever develop the disease. Now, there are some other risk factors that people have that are within their control. There are many lifestyle factors that, with slight adjustment of lifestyle, can greatly reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. In fact, there were some studies that came out of AAIC, or the Alzheimer's Association International Conference, last year that suggested sort of this multi-component lifestyle change or factor can reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease even more than if you had no genetic factors whatsoever.
So what kinds of things should we be doing?
Well, there's four major areas. It's about exercise, it's about diet, it's about keeping socially active and engaged with other people, and it's about challenging yourself cognitively. So learning new things, doing puzzles, talking to other people, challenging yourself to do, you know, things that you've never done before. There is a new study called the Pointer Study that the Alzheimer's Association is investing in right now. It's a two-year clinical trial that is testing the effectiveness of these lifestyle changes in reducing the risk of dementia and Alzheimer's disease.
So use it or lose it, in a sense.
Use it or lose it. Yeah, absolutely. And we do have more information on that at ALZ.org. So if people are interested in improving their brain health and preventing dementia to the best of their ability, we can help them do that.
Jennifer Howard is the executive director of the Michigan Great Lakes chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
The rise in student activism and interest in politics is certainly being felt all across the country. We've seen it, of course, with the students from Mary Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida. One example right here in Michigan is a debate this coming Sunday evening among some of the Democrats running for governor. It's being held at Bloomfield Hills High School, and it's being put on and moderated by a student-founded and student-run nonprofit group called Engage 18. Co-founders Zachariah Farah and Michael Goldman Brown Jr. are here with us now. Both of them seniors at Bloomfield Hills High School. Welcome. Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It is.
Zachariah, why did you guys get together and launch Engage 18? And when did it happen?
Well, it started off with the planning for the debate. And that actually started as a joke. Michael came up to me and he said, wouldn't it be funny if we moderated a presidential debate? And of course, that was just a joke. But then we started thinking, why couldn't we just host a gubernatorial debate? And we just thought, well, why not? There was no good reason why we couldn't get involved. We're both registered voters at this point. And yeah, we just wanted to get engaged, hence the name Engage 18.
So this was prior to Parkland. This has been going on a while.
Yes, it began in August, and we actually sent our first email, which really kicked it off, to the director of our theater in January.
And that's because you're going to have it at the performing arts space, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be this Sunday, and I know you've got three of the candidates. Who's coming?
Abdul El-Sayed, Sri Tanadar, and Bill Cobbs.
Did you invite Gretchen Whitmer?
We did, and we really would have loved to have her there, but unfortunately she was unable to come. We also asked for them to send a representative on her behalf to display her policies, but they said it was against their policy as a campaign. So we will be reading a statement that they supplied to us.
What about the other side? Was there thought of inviting anyone from the Republican side or any of the other parties?
Well, we were thinking about inviting Republican candidates and also having a sort of complete roundtable. But given that there were six Republican candidates, we thought it would be simpler to focus on the Democratic side. We are in talks amongst ourselves, and I believe we've reached out to a Republican gubernatorial candidate about hosting a potential Republican debate also.
What are you hoping to make happen through having this debate?
Well, first of all, considering the fact that it's going to be held at a high school, there's going to be a high attendance rate of high school students. And I think especially the fact that Abdul El-Sayed is an alum of our district, that'll really spark some interest in these students and hopefully get them involved in politics.
You know, as you think of your friends, your fellow students, other members of Engage 18, what are you seeing in terms of the level of political interest and even activism, let's say, over the last couple of years?
Well, initially, I was seeing a sort of low level of political interest. I remember in middle school and even now when I'll ask students at my school if they know what precinct they're in or if they know who their congressman is or their congresswoman or even who their township supervisor or mayor is, they'll give me a blank stare because they're quite frankly unsure, and I think that's almost scary. But I feel like with our direction on the March 14th walkout, we've been focusing on specific congressmen and congresswomen and specific pieces of legislation, and I feel like people are becoming more aware of who their congresspeople are and how state government and even the federal government functions, which I think is great.
What kind of concerns, what kind of issues do students talk about?
Well, there's quite a few, and I think that recent political events have kind of inspired this tone of nihilism among students.
What kind of events?
Well, these, first of all, the inaction regarding gun control, a couple past elections that really went different ways than I know students wanted them to go. There was a lot of young people who were really interested in the Bernie Sanders campaign, and that was shut down, and hopefully there's a continuation of that student interest in campaigns such as that.
What do you and other students think about our current elected officials in Michigan, mm-hmm. talking about Governor Snyder, talking about the state legislature, because you're having this gubernatorial debate. When people think of who's representing them in Lansing, is there a feeling of connection? Do they feel represented?
Not at all. I think that it's very disconnected. I think to begin, practically everyone who works and studies in a public school is basically on the same page about the necessity of increasing funds to public education. Furthermore, I know that although our school administration cannot publicly state this, a lot of staff and in many schools across Michigan and across the country would like to see gun control measures increase in specific ways. And at this point, a lot of them are simply asking to not make things worse and not allow teachers to be armed or to allow concealed carry weapons on school premises.
What do you feel?
I've heard a lot about the topic of gun legislation as well. Also, a big consideration in regards to Governor Snyder is about the Flint water crisis, which I actually heard students talking about today in one of my classes and how that's still going on. And a lot of people, quite frankly, in Bloomfield Hills are shocked that something like that could happen to such a large group of people and that there's been such inaction on it on a state level and on a federal level as well. And it's really been sort of a point of content for them with the state government. But another large issue I'd probably say is infrastructure. Basically, every student I know who drives complains about the roads in the state and the potholes and the way that everything feels as if it's in decay and the fact that we're, quite frankly, not funding our infrastructure.
Well, it's funny because we just talked with the director of the Michigan Department of Transportation who said we have got to think about the roads that we inherited, our generation, from the previous generation, and what we are leaving to your generation. He said we've got to think about that and about funding.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a side note here, if you look across the Canadian border, you can see that their roads are practically in pristine condition. So when people say that it's just a weather issue, that's simply not true. We can have nice roads. We can have nice schools. We just choose not to. We don't want to pay for it. And I think the disconnect between our politicians and the public is a serious issue that we want to solve.
Any thoughts of expanding Engage 18 to schools throughout Michigan? Have you gotten any people that are on board with this?
Yeah, we have students working with us in over a dozen high schools for other initiatives that we've been working on, not necessarily the debate, even though we will have students from other schools helping us to operate the debate. The coordination with those other schools has largely been with in regards to the March 14th walkout. Most of the schools are in Oakland County, although I do know we are working with at least one school outside of the county in Lapeer.
What do you want to hear from the three candidates this Sunday?
Well, I want to hear them get specifically into what policies they stand for. I want to see them differentiate themselves, and I want to see solutions that not only are going to help students, even though we are students and the point of the debate is sort of to engage more students in politics, but I want to hear about their solutions to problems that all Michiganders are facing.
Is this open to the public?
It is. It's free general admission and anyone can attend.
So it's 6 to 8 p.m. Sunday night.
Yes.
At Bloomfield Hills High School, right at Telegraph and Long Lake Road in Bloomfield Hills. Zachariah Farah is a senior at Bloomfield Hills High School, as is Michael Goldman Brown Jr., the co-founders of the nonprofit student-run group Engage 18, hosting and moderating a formal debate among Democratic gubernatorial candidates Abdullah Sayed, Sri Tanadar, and Bill Cobbs. Thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside, guys.
Thank you very much, Cindy.
Thank you for having us.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Peggy Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Horan, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.